All right, so this is March 1st, Bio 160, and we're just going to finish up some actions before we get into the muscle system. All right, so most of these actions right here are what we call antagonistic to each other, which means what? They perform opposite to each other. And the first thing that we're going to talk about is extension and flexion right here. Extension is when you have a joint and we increase the angle between two bones. So extension is increasing the angle between two bones is extension, as opposed to flexion is when we decrease the angle. Can you see this is 90 degrees? Less than 90 degrees, that's flexion. If we're at 45 degrees and go to 90, that's increasing the angle, that's extension. Or if we go from 45 to 180, that's extension. Right? And that's extension across my elbow. We can extend what? Our fingers. And we can even extend our wrist like that. Extension. All right, so what motion is this? Curling my fingers up. That's flexion because that's decreasing the angle. Extension is increasing the angle. All right, and then the figure that you have in your book is at the knee. So if my knee is straight 180 degrees, if I decrease the angle, that is flexion. And if I increase it, that's extension. And maybe you can see that kind of motion right here on this diagram. Yeah, do you see that motion right there? Okay, there's another kind. So they're opposite each other. Let's talk about the biceps, which is in my forearm. This is flexion and extension. They're antagonistic motions, right? They're opposite to each other. And nonetheless, so we call that antagonistic control. And when somebody says antagonism, do you have kind of a good connotation or a bad connotation? Bad connotation, right? You don't want to be around antagonistic people all the time. But in terms of physiology and in terms of control systems, antagonism is actually a very good thing to have. Because with antagonism, you get precise control and balance over your body. So there are two important muscles that control where my forearm is moving. There's a flexor right here called the biceps, and then there's an extensor called the triceps. So the position of my hand is being controlled by the relative activity of the biceps and the triceps, so I have good precise control of my hand or my fingertip. And that could be real important, say tomorrow night on your way home after work and after happy hour, and you get pulled over by that person with the shiny badge and the sidearm and the blue uniform, right? And they say, okay, with your eyes closed, I want you to put your finger right on the tip of your nose without looking. Okay, and so what would you employ? You would employ antagonism, not against the officer, but within your arm, right, so that you have precise control and balance over your fingertips so that you don't sock yourself in the nose or sock him in the nose or whatever. And in case you're just a little bit drunk, then you're not going to have that precise control balance, antagonistic control over your forearm. So antagonism is actually, in terms of control systems, a very good thing to have. It provides for what? Control and balance of something. Okay, so here's that hand again. I want to show you one other thing. This flexion is decreasing the angle, extension is increasing, but the wrist, you can even hyperextend. Okay, and that's okay with the wrist. The wrist you can hyperextend, but there are a number of joints you cannot hyperextend. For instance, the knee. You can flex and you can extend across the knee, but do you ever want to hyperextend the knee? No, that's going to make all kinds of really bad sounds if that happens, right? So some joints you can hyperextend, other joints you don't ever want to hyperextend. Okay, what else do we have that is antagonistic in nature? When we have our limbs, and this could be arms or legs, when we move our limbs away from our body, we call that abduction with a B, abduction. And when we bring our limbs together with our body, we call that adduction. So when you add your limbs to your body, that's adduction. And the same thing can happen with your fingers. When you spread your fingers apart, that is abduction. And when you bring your fingers together, you add them together, that's adduction. So you can do that with arms, you can do that with legs, toes, fingers, that kind of thing. Antagonistic motion, again, is the important thing. Here are two that are a little funny, and that is the motion at your ankle right here. You see dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. So they're both flexion, and that's because your ankle is not really like your wrist, and your elbow is not really like your knee, right? So if you were to turn, make your upper appendage kind of look like your knee, what would you have to do? You'd have to kind of rotate it around, but then the surface of your hand doesn't match. It'd have to be kind of, it's just really weird. So they came up with a couple different names to talk about what you do with your ankle. If you lift your toes up off the ground, we call that dorsiflexion. And if you point your toes into the ground, we call that plantar flexion, like planting your toes into the ground. Plantar flexion versus dorsiflexion. The ankle right here, it's kind of complicated, but probably the best way to think of that is a hinge joint, and it's a synovial joint. It's a freely movable joint. But because you have a number of ankle bones right there, not only can you plantar flex and dorsiflex, but you can do this kind of thing to it. Okay, inversion, eversion, and then if you do combinations of things, we call it pronation and supination. All right, but even in an anatomy class, I don't get into pronation and supination at the ankle because it's a combination of a couple different kinds of motions. But if you're an athlete, you're probably interested in knowing the definitions for pronation and supination. But I'll tell you what it is with respect to the palm of your hand. Right, and then maybe you can apply it to the ankle. But for a good first approximation, the ankle is purely a hinge joint. Okay, let's see. So here we have, now when you have a ball and socket joint, like in your shoulder and in your hip, you have a lot of range of motion. You can do more than just a hinge joint, right? You can do flexion, extension, adduction, or abduction, adduction, all with your shoulder. As a matter of fact, you can even make a big windmill motion like this, which is combinations of all different kinds of these standard motions. And that's what we call circumduction. So with a ball and socket, you can do circumduction. With your leg, you can do circumduction as well. Okay. Here's one that was on the test. I don't know if anybody got this one or not. And that's pronation and supination. It's antagonistic motion. All right, with the palms of your hands, what's anatomic position? Your palms should be facing which way?
Forward, thumbs.
Yeah, thumbs. Thumbs forward or thumbs anteriorly, palms of your hands facing forward, right? That's anatomical position. So when you take the palms of your hands and rotate them to face posteriorly, we call that pronation. So palms facing posterior, that's pronation. When you turn the palms of your hands so that they're facing anterior, we call that supination. One way to remember that is if you put your palms together when they're supinated, it forms what? A soup bowl. Okay? So that's one easy way to remember supination versus pronation. And let's see. A couple other things. With your jaw, you can do a couple things with your jaw. You can stick it out, that's called protraction, or you can pull it in, that's retraction. All right, protraction, retraction. You can also elevate your jaw, in which case I can't talk, or you can open your mouth, that's called depression, right? Elevation versus depression, and you can do elevation and depression with your shoulders too. When you shrug your shoulders, that's elevation. When you depress your shoulders, that's depression. Okay. Another motion that the close to the ankle is eversion and inversion. So eversion is when you rotate your ankle outward like that. Inversion is when you rotate your ankle or the palm of your foot inward. And it's a lot easier just because of the arrangement of muscles to invert an ankle than it is to evert an ankle. So most people, when they sprain an ankle, they invert it because it's not as strong a motion, all right? But if you sprain your ankle with an eversion like this, all right, that's a much worse kind of injury, and probably a lot of bones are going to break in there. So inversion is the most common kind of ankle sprain, but it's relatively easy to do, and you can recover relatively easily as opposed to when it's inverted. All right, so those are some important kinds of motions, and I'm sure we're going to say flexion and extension in a lot of here. So you got to know flexion and extension. Anybody have any questions on those motions? Okay. That's just a little recap from last time. All right, so now we're going to move on to muscle. Okay, so some functions of the muscular system. Oh, yeah, some functions of skeletal. I've seen skeleton right there. It doesn't say that. It says skeletal muscle. All right, now what kind of muscle is skeletal muscle? It is what we call voluntary. It's under voluntary control. All right, so that means movement is under your voluntary control. Posture, you can sit up straight. Okay, you can kind of be slouching over. And posture muscles actually are very important for posture, because even though you're just sitting there doing nothing, you're at least holding yourself in the chair. If you were to completely relax every muscle in your body, you'd end up on the floor, right? Right here, contraction. Yeah, so muscle, skeletal muscle is specialized to contract, to shorten. And when muscles contract, they produce heat, which is real important because it's rare that you're in an environment that's 98.6 degrees or whatever the normal body temperature. It's always less than that. And muscles produce heat to keep you at just your normal body temperature. And another important function is joint stabilization. It keeps joints in their proper position and location and movement so that they don't get harmed. We said the knee is really what? Just a hinge joint. It just flexes and extends. And muscles protect the knee from damage so it doesn't hyperextend, right? Or so that at the knee it doesn't adduct or abduct either. In which case then that joint would be injured. And as a matter of fact, if you ever injure an ankle or a knee or a shoulder or any kind of joint, it's actually hard to recover from that kind of injury. Joints don't heal very well. And the best way to help a joint once it's injured, right, is not necessarily to work the joint, but you want to exercise things that are around the joint, namely the muscles that work across the joint. So the only way to help stabilize a joint after it's been injured is to work on muscles that are around that joint to help stabilize it again. So if you have a bad knee, what muscles do you want to work on? Okay, like the muscles in your anterior thigh, maybe even posterior thigh, and even down in your leg over here to help stabilize your knee. Okay, those are the exercises that you do. Yeah, when you dislocate a shoulder, sometimes it's damaging, sometimes it's not so bad. Sometimes you can just reduce it, pop it right back in there. Okay. Will it happen again? Yeah, you're more prone to have that happen again because now the ligaments and tendons that hold your arm into the scapula, they're stretched out. All right, so the ligaments you can't ever shorten again and the tendons you can't ever shorten again. They're stretched. So the only thing you can do to protect your shoulder then is to work on muscles that go across the shoulder. All right, and when the muscles will actually shorten and pull on the tendons to give them the tension again because the tendons have been stretched out. But if the muscle gets shorter, then you can still get tension on that tendon. All right, so when you injure a joint, you got to work on the muscles around that joint to make it strong again because it's only the muscles that can change shape, but the ligaments and the tendons can't change shape again unless you go back in with surgery and shorten them with surgery. But guess what? Every time you do surgery, there's always some little complications, right? So you always have to weigh the benefits versus the risks. And that's what doctors get paid a lot of money for, okay? Rotator cuff, I think I'm going to talk about that. There's four muscles that are involved in that. And it's a very common injury of the shoulder. If somebody has a rotator cuff tear, I don't think you're more predisposed to dislocations. But you're certainly prone to a lot of pain. Okay, it can be painful. And the kind of motion that a rotator cuff responds to is what we call, and I didn't mention this in the, it's not flexion or extension, it's a rotation of the bone in your arm called the humerus. Right, so rotator cuff tear is involved with this kind of motion. And even a better way to see a rotator cuff is flex at the elbow so that your forearm is pointing anteriorly. And now you can rotate the humerus very easily. Like this is what, a medial rotation? This is a lateral rotation. Somebody with a rotator cuff tear, if you apply pressure when they try to laterally rotate, that will cause excruciating pain in the shoulder. So it would be the lateral rotation, not the medial rotation, right? Not abduction, adduction, okay, or flexion and extension, but this particular motion right here. So to help get over that, I would strengthen all of those motions. I would do exercises for flexion. I would do, abduction, adduction. I would even then gently start to work rotation exercises in the humerus, and that would maybe help you compensate for that rotator cuff tear. Okay, but if not, then it has to be repaired surgically. And there's actually some excellent procedures, but there's a trade-off associated with that. It will make your shoulder extremely strong, but you'll have a reduced range of motion. Instead of being able to raise your arm up like that, you might only be able to raise it up to this level right here. You'll have an incredibly strong shoulder, but you just won't have the same range of motion. I've known some people that play racquetball to have that surgery repair for a rotator cuff, and they can smack the ball two or three times as hard, but they just don't have the same range of motion. It's kind of funny, yeah. Most common activity. Maybe baseball is. But football can. If you go up to block a pass, all right, and you're hit on the shoulder and somebody throws the ball really hard and just moves your whole arm posterior like that, that can give you a rotator cuff tear too. Yeah. All right, well, let's move on with muscle a little bit. Is there another question? No? Okay. But rotator cuffs are very common. Very, very common. Muscle structure. Here are some things that help make up a muscle. And we've got a good picture in your book that shows all these different parts of a muscle. And when I say muscle, I mean a big muscle, like your biceps. All the components of the biceps right here. Surrounding the muscle is a fascia. And then the whole muscle then is broken up into little bundles that we call muscle bundles. And something that makes a bundle is a muscle fiber. So these are just different levels of organization of a muscle. Each one of these down here is the building block for this thing up over here. So let me show you a picture so that you can see it. All right, so here's a muscle. And surrounding this whole muscle right here is what we call fascia. And furthermore, the fascia can be broken up into each one of these little bundles right over here. And sometimes this bundle right here is called a fascicle. And then fascicles can be broken up right into this. Each one of these right here is actually a muscle cell. So muscle cells, a whole bunch of muscle cells will make a fascicle. A whole bunch of fascicles will make up a whole muscle. Furthermore, inside a muscle cell, the muscle cell is sometimes what we call a fiber because they're very long and narrow. There are other bundles of things called myofibrils, long tubular structures within a muscle fiber. And even within a myofibril, there are long filamentous kinds of proteins that we call filaments. So this is how we completely break down a muscle. The simplest building block would be a filament. If we put a bunch of filaments together, we get a myofibril. And if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, we get a fiber. We put a bunch of fibers together, we get a fascicle. And if we put a whole bunch of fascicles together, we get that whole big muscle. So that's how we break a muscle down. On either end of a muscle, there's going to be some connective tissue called a tendon that will attach it to a bone. And that's dense, regular connective tissue. And these tendons, like I said before, they don't heal very well. And once they're stretched, they stay stretched, they don't shorten. So if you want to apply tension on a joint, you have to work on the muscle to pull a little bit harder on that tendon. But that's okay because it's easy with exercise to improve upon a muscle, but you can't a tendon necessarily. All right, so the fascia is just a connective tissue sheath that surrounds and separates different muscles. like maybe the biceps muscle from the brachialis, which is in this part of your body right here. It's surrounded by fascia. All right? It also divides muscle into numerous muscle bundles, which we sometimes call a fascicle. And a fascicle is made up of what? Many muscle cells. And a muscle cell is just a really long cell. So sometimes we call it a fiber. So a muscle fiber is a muscle cell. The funny thing about muscle cells is that they contain many nuclei. So in your idea of a cell, how many nuclei should it have? Probably just one, right? Every picture maybe that you've seen of a cell just has one nucleus. But a muscle cell has many because it's real long. And the reason why that is because a muscle cell or a muscle fiber was at one time maybe 100 or 1,000 separate different cells that have fused together. The membrane between them disappeared, but yet still all those nuclei are in there from the original cells before they fused. A muscle fiber also has an extensive endoplasmic reticulum. And I'll show you that in a second. Okay, and it also is filled with myofibrils, which extend the extent of the fibril. So here is a muscle cell right here, and this yellow thing right here is the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Sometimes in a regular cell, we would just call that the endoplasmic reticulum. But anytime you hear sarco, guess what you should think of? A muscle. Just when you hear chondro, you should think of cartilage. Or when you hear osteo, you should think of bone. When you hear sarco, you should think of muscle. So here is endoplasmic reticulum inside a muscle. So we call that sarcoplasmic reticulum. And here's the plasma membrane around this muscle fiber. We don't call it a plasma membrane. We call it the sarcolemma, because sarco means around that muscle cell right here. All right, let's get down into this level right over here, filaments. Okay, myofilaments come in two different kinds. There's something called actin, and actin is very thin. So what does AKA stand for? Yeah, okay, I'm glad to know that I'm not the only one that has AKAs. All right, also known as. All right, and myosin is also known as a thick. So the actin is thin, myosin is thick. And a sarcomere has repeated units of both actin and myosin going from one end of the cell all the way to the other. Okay. And there is a unit inside of a cell that's called a sarcomere. So here is a sarcomere. Here you can see the myofilaments. And for instance, this one right here, what's that one? Is that a thick or a thin one? That's a thick one. So we call that, the thick one is myosin. Yeah, myosin is a thick one. And then this thin one, the little one, the thin one right here, that's the actin. And notice how each surrounds the other. So one myosin is going to be surrounded by actin, and an actin is going to be surrounded by, like, myosin, just because of the arrangement inside the cell. All right, so this thing with all of these myofilaments is called a myofibril. So here's one myofibril, and there are many within one muscle cell. Now, there's some other things that you might notice. See the zigzag line over here? It's a repeating unit. It starts here, and it ends here, and then it ends here, right? And it just goes on forever from one end of the cell all the way to the other. This structure between these zigzag lines, which we call the Z line, that's the sarcomere. So each myofibril is going to have 1,000 of these sarcomeres lining up from end to end. And it's this thing right here, namely the sarcomere. If we understand how a sarcomere works, we understand how a whole muscle works. So we're going to focus our attention on this thing that we see as a sarcomere. And what are the two kinds of filaments that we have inside the sarcomere? You got actin and myosin. Okay? You got actin and myosin. And what you have to know are what the endpoints of a sarcomere are. What are the endpoints? The Z lines. Right? They got there's other things in there, like there's A band and H zone and I band and all that kind of stuff. We're not going to get into that. The only thing that I want you to know are what? The Z, right? The Z lines right here. Okay. So where's my sheet? Right here. All right, so the Z lines define the edge of the sarcomere, and they form attachment points for the actin filaments. Can you see that? Here is an actin molecule, and it attaches to the Z line. But the myosin is what? It's just floating inside the sarcomere. It's not attached to the Z line specifically. And sarcomeres line up from end to end within the myofibril and give skeletal muscle its characteristic striated appearance. If you look underneath a microscope at skeletal muscle, you'll see these striations. It will look striped. Because why? These sarcomeres line up from end to end to end, from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. All right, so what have I said? A lot of stuff so far. But here is just a review of the muscle structure organization. First, you start with the whole muscle, okay? And then you can break a muscle up into smaller compartments that we call a bundle or a fascicle. And then what makes up a fascicle are muscle fibers or cells. And within a cell, you have myofibrils. Right, so you have hundreds of myofibrils making up a cell, but we can break a myofibril up into smaller parts, namely myofilaments, are the small proteins inside a myofibril. And then furthermore, you know now two names of myofilaments. The thick one is myosin, and a thin one is actin. So if you put a bunch of actin and myosin together, right, you get myofilaments. If you put a bunch of myofilaments together, you get myofibrils. You put a bunch of myofibrils together, you get a muscle cell. And if you put a bunch of muscle cells together, you get that bundle or fascicle. And if you put a bunch of fascicles together, you get what, that whole muscle, for instance. All right, so that's the building block nature of muscle. Okay, so how does muscle work? Let's see if I'm on the right page. 3, 4. Yeah, I think we're doing good. Okay. So the sarcomere shortens or contracts as a result of actin and myosin filaments sliding past each other. Okay, it's interesting. I used to think that when a muscle shortened, that the actin and myosin proteins themselves would shorten. So what do those things look like? All right, here's myosin and here's actin. I used to think that maybe the myosin would actually shorten, or that this actin would actually shorten. But that's not what happens. All right, those things just slide past each other. So let's take a look at a slide. That shows that. So here's a slide that shows a Z line here and a Z line here. What does that define? It defines a sarcomere, one sarcomere. And attached to the Z lines is this actin molecule here, and actin here, actin here, actin here. And floating in between the actin is a myosin molecule. And this is a muscle that's at rest. When muscle starts to contract, right, these Z lines get closer together. But not just these Z lines, but the Z lines where? Thousands of times over repeated from one end of the muscle cell to the other. So all of the Z lines get closer together and the whole muscle shortens. Okay, but let's look at the length of this myosin here from here to here compared to what it was here and here. You see a difference. It actually looks kind of the same. It should look the same length. What about the length of this actin from here to here compared to here to here? This length right here and this length right here. It looks the same. The myosin goes from here to here. Pretty much the same length. So how is it that these Z lines actually get closer together? Right? And it's ingenious how nature has figured this out. So let's pretend that these two pens that I have are actin and myosin. All right? And they're next to each other. When a muscle is at rest, they overlap just a little bit. But as muscle starts to contract, guess what happens to actin and myosin? Okay, let me grab hold. All right, so here's that actin and myosin. As muscle starts to contract, the actin and myosin slide past each other. And as they slide past each other, what happens to the Z lines? Yeah, they get pulled together as a result of that. So the question is, does either actin or myosin shorten when a muscle shortens? You know, they don't. They just do what? They just slide past each other. So we call that the sliding filament model for muscle contraction. And it, as a matter of fact, you can actually see now that the overlap for a fully contracted muscle is almost 100%, while here it's just a fraction of an overlap between the actin and myosin. So I'm sure that's a review question in your notes. Okay, what proteins shorten when a muscle contracts? You would say? None. The only thing that happens is what? Actin and myosin slide past each other, right? Okay. And that's the sliding filament mechanism for muscle contraction. What happened to it? Number five. Okay. Okay, just a couple more details with that sliding filament mechanism. All right, so sarcomere shortens or contracts as a result of actin and myosin sliding past each other. All right, don't forget, actin and myosin don't shorten. They just slide past each other. And the reason why they slide past each other is because of something called a cross bridge. All right, there is a cross bridge. There's a part of the myosin molecule. Right here. So now we're really zooming in. Here's the myosin molecule, and here are some cross bridges. But when the muscle is rested, the cross bridge doesn't touch the actin. It doesn't reach up and touch the actin. Right? But when a cell is told to contract, these proteins move out of the way, and the cross bridges can form, can reach up and grab hold of the actin. So let's take a look at this slide. So here we see a myosin, here we see an actin, and they're not touching each other. Is that muscle contracted? No, and it can't contract. Okay. So what happens is calcium is let into the cell, and it moves this molecule, which we call tropomyosin, off of the actin molecule in just the right way so that this cross bridge can reach up and grab hold of the actin. So myosin can attach itself to actin, right? And with the presence of ATP, that cross bridge can go from this kind of configuration to, and it snaps like this. See that cross bridge kind of articulates? It ratchets forward or backwards. And when it ratchets backwards like this, it forces what? The sliding of actin and myosin past each other, like that. ATP is necessary for the release of that cross bridge from the actin molecule, and then it reaches forward again. Okay, and it can, and if there's still a stimulus for contraction, it can, the myosin head group can grab the actin molecule again, grab hold, and ratchet one more time, and this repeated cycle can happen over and over and over again, pulling what? Actin and myosin past each other. Okay, so none of these proteins shorten right here. They only slide past each other. So what do we have? So cross-bridge formation on myosin to actin causes the proteins to slide past each other. As the actin and myosin proteins slide past each other, the Z lines of the sarcomere come together and the muscle fiber shortens or contracts. And the cycling of these cross bridges from myosin to actin is dependent on ATP. So ATP is necessary for that to take place. Now, where do you get that ATP from? ATP. I think we talked about metabolism at one point in time. That's like what? Respiration, cellular respiration, producing ATP, where we take glucose and we break glucose down into pyruvate and we get a couple ATP molecules. And without oxygen, that gets turned into lactic acid. But if there is oxygen, then that pyruvic acid can enter a mitochondria. And aerobically, then, it can produce 34 ATP. So don't forget, anaerobic respiration can only produce 2 ATP, but with oxygen, an additional 34 can be produced. And that's where the energy for muscle contraction comes from. So what energy molecule is required for muscle contraction? What would you say? It's that ATP. All right, and then ATP, as a matter of fact, I think this was one of the figures on the exam last time. ATP, when it gets hydrolyzed into ADP, an inorganic phosphate, it releases a lot of energy, which can be used for cross-bridge cycling or the sliding of actin and myosin past each other. Are you guys okay? Okay. I know how that can go. Okay. All right, so where is most of the ATP produced in your body? Would be mitochondria. And how does that happen? Well, mitochondria need oxygen. They need fuel. What's the fuel molecule? Glucose, for instance, right? All right, it also needs ADP and inorganic phosphate in order to make ATP. Mitochondria then convert that fuel, namely glucose, into CO2, and then some water is produced with those oxygens that we inhale, and it produces about 36 ATP. Oh, and here's the fuel, glucose, and it can also metabolize some fatty acids to produce a lot of ATP. Okay, types of ATP production. Basically, you got two types. I think this is a review for us. You got aerobic respiration versus anaerobic respiration. And you should remember where these take place. Aerobic is in mitochondria. Anaerobic is in the cytoplasm. Right? The substrates for aerobic respiration, glucose and maybe fatty acids. You need oxygen, right? Because it is aerobic respiration. And then you also need ADP and inorganic phosphate. And the products are 38 ATP, CO2, and water for every glucose molecule. As opposed to anaerobic respiration, which means what? I'm about ready to start coughing. Hold on. Okay, that's located in the cytoplasm. Anaerobic respiration is in the cytoplasm, does not require oxygen. The only substrate there is glucose, not fatty acids, and how many ATP? Measly 2. All right, and then also some lactate is going to be produced as well, anaerobically. So that's what a muscle needs to contract. All right, now muscles do get tired when they start contracting. How is it that they get tired? Well, a couple different ways. We call that fatigue. All right, fatigue, real muscle fatigue could be due to decreased availability of ATP. Maybe the muscle isn't producing ATP for some reason. Maybe you're contracting it greatly. And when you're contracting that muscle, it's cutting off blood supply to it. It's cutting off oxygen, and then the mitochondria can't produce a lot of ATP, right? And when that happens, it also produces a lot of lactate. So decreased ATP or increased lactic acid will directly make a muscle weaker, which is what we call fatigue. And there's really nothing you can do about that. The second one is what we call psychological fatigue. So for instance, when you use a muscle and you build up lactic acid, you have a sensation of that happening. It feels bad. Right? And so just that sensation of fatigue, right, that bad feeling, all right, is what we call psychological fatigue. And somebody is going to not want to prolong that kind of sensation or that kind of feeling. And you'll stop exercising. Unless you're getting paid $1 million a game as a basketball player. And if your muscles feel fatigued or tired, what do you say? Oh, so what? They're still contracting. I'll still use them. All right, so you can overcome psychological fatigue with training. And with training, you can, okay, you can attenuate the effect of real muscle fatigue, but only up to a point. Say that again? Yeah, certainly if you press a muscle past its normal function, even without fatigue, if you voluntarily contract your biceps extremely one time, okay, you certainly could rip it, all right? And so if you are lifting weights or something and you're doing an extreme exercise over and over again, you'll just have a greater tendency to rip that muscle, all right, to rip a fascicle or a bundle. And then, of course, you're gonna have to rest that muscle for it to rebuild itself. Okay. Now, if you're using that muscle appropriately and it just hurts, okay, then at certain times it's appropriate to do that kind of exercise, because there is a thing called a plateau. If you exercise a constant amount every single day, your body will only reach a certain level of strength or ability. And somehow you have to break that plateau, and sometimes you do that by going to a different exercise or doing some extreme exercise to break through that threshold. And then you reach another threshold, and then you got to design some kind of activity to get through the next threshold. And sometimes that could be very painful, but then you break through that threshold and you have increased ability or strength in that particular muscle. Yeah. So those are some topics regarding exercise and fatigue. Okay. 9. All right, let's start talking about some anatomy of muscle. Most muscles extend from one bone to another and across a joint, so they're attached to two different bones. And when that muscle contracts, what does it do to those two bones? It's going to pull them together, right? Because that's what muscle does. It pulls bones together. But there's usually a joint between the bones so that the bones move in a proper way. Right, with some kind of maybe flexion, extension, or adduction, or however the joint was designed. Right, and muscles have attachment points. Right, muscles basically have two ends because they're attached to two different bones. And we talk about the ends differently depending on what they do. And we call those things the origin and insertion. And it's not really arbitrary. The origin is the most stationary end or attachment point to a muscle. And the insertion is the more movable end of a muscle. And it's attached to the bone undergoing the most kind of motion. All right. For instance, your biceps that's in your arm over here, when the biceps contracts, what part of my body moves? Does my shoulder move? Does my arm move? Or does my forearm move? The forearm mostly moves. I mean, my arm might move a little bit. All right, but mostly, for sure, it's my forearm. So the origin of the biceps is going to be attached to either the humerus or up in my shoulder right here, because that's the part of my body that's not moving. The insertion is going to be in my forearm because that's the part of my body that is moving. So insertion is what? The more movable end of a muscle. The origin is the more stationary end. Okay, another one. The rectus abdominis muscle. It goes from my sternum over here to my hip bone. As a matter of fact, the pubis of your hip bone. And when you contract your abdominal muscles, guess what moves? Do your hips move or does your chest move? Your chest moves. So the origin would be the pubis bone and the insertion would be the sternum right here, because it's the sternum that's really moving, right, when I contract the abdominal muscles. So that's just a good definition. And if during a test you want to know what the origin insertion is of a muscle, just contract it once and see what moves. Right? The insertion is going to be the end of the muscle that moves. Okay. Then we have muscles with different kinds of attributes. We call them synergist muscles and antagonistic muscles. Muscles that work together to perform the same motion are what we call synergists. A good example of that would be the biceps brachii and the brachialis. Both of them are in your arm, the anterior compartment of your arm. You're all familiar with the biceps, but right underneath the biceps is the brachialis. And when they contract, they cause, what was that motion? When they contract, ooh, I feel that biceps contracting, massively contracting right there. What is that? That is flexion. Okay? So both the biceps and the brachialis cause flexion, so we call that a synergist muscle. Furthermore, one of these two muscles is going to play the major role in producing that motion. They're not equal. And in this particular case, you might think that the biceps actually is the strongest muscle that produces that motion, but it's not. It's actually the brachialis, the one underneath it, is actually the stronger one. And because of that, we call that one the prime mover. So the brachialis is the prime mover. All right. The other thing is the antagonistic muscles. Now, what can you tell me about antagonism again? How does it work? Against each other, in opposition to each other. So if the biceps, which is here in the arm, causes flexion of the forearm, you have a muscle in the posterior compartment, when it contracts, is going to cause extension. Right? Biceps flexion, the triceps is actually going to be extension. Those are antagonistic muscles. But why is that important? Because with the biceps and triceps, you have antagonistic control over, for instance, your fingertip. So it gives you balance and precise control, antagonistic muscles. Here's a picture of the biceps right here in the anterior part of your arm, and the triceps would be in this location over here, right, in the opposing body compartment. So it's going to oppose the motion of the biceps. So there's a lot of muscles in the body we like to know about in terms of their antagonistic motion, and a good example would be what? The biceps and the triceps over here. So let's look at, lastly, some muscles. First, in the head region. So these are the only muscles that I would ever ask you to know actions of, origins, and insertions. These three right here. In terms of the head, there's a muscle called the occipital frontalis. All right, and that seems like a mouthful, but let's take a look at the occipital frontalis. All right, so here's a picture of somebody's head. The frontal bone of the skull is right here. Maybe you can remember that from the test. And what was that bone all the way in the back of the head? Occipital bone. All right, so when you say occipital frontalis, you think of the bones that we're talking about, namely the occipital bone and frontal bone. So here's a muscle that goes from occipital bone to frontal bone. And what's really nice about nomenclature is when you look at the word occipital frontalis, it tells you what the origin and insertion is. The origin comes first and the insertion comes second in the word. So occipital would be what? The origin, and then frontalis is the insertion because it comes second part of the word. Now, which one is the more movable end, the origin or the insertion? The insertion. So when the occipital frontalis contracts, guess what end moves? Does your occipital bone move or Do your eyebrows move? Because the frontalis is attached to the skin of your eyebrows. Can you raise your eyebrows? Yeah, you sure can. That's your occipital frontalis, and you can probably feel these things contracting. Right? Occipital frontalis. It goes by different names. Epicranius is another name for it. And right on the top of your head, you don't have a muscle there per se. That's just a broad, flat, tendinous sheath that we call an aponeurosis. Right, so that's just a broad, flat tendon that pulls on each other. So if you want to raise your eyebrows, that's the what? Occipito frontalis. Okay. So just by knowing somebody gives you the name of a muscle, you know a lot about the muscle. You know its origin and insertion, and then you can figure out its action. All right, here's another mouthful. Some muscles in the neck. Okay, the sternocleidomastoid. That's a good one, but it's easy. Okay, it's not hard to understand. Again, just by knowing nomenclature. Sternum. Sterno means sternum. Where's your sternum at? Yeah, right here. That's your sternum. All right, and cleido means clavicle. Where's your clavicle at? Right here. So here's your sternum and clavicle. That's the origin of that muscle. All right, the sternum and the clavicle. And the insertion is the mastoid process on the temporal bone. Can you remember that from the test? The mastoid process is back over here behind your earlobe. Now that's the insertion. So is the insertion, again, the more movable point or more stationary point? More movable. So when the sternocleidomastoid contracts, guess what moves? Your sternum or your head? You know your head moves because that's the insertion. And you got two of them. You got one sternocleidomastoid here and you got one sternocleidomastoid here. If they both contract, you have flexion of the neck. Right? It flexes the neck like that. But you can contract one or the other. And if you just contract one and relax the other, okay, then it produces this kind of motion. So we call that just what? A lateral rotation of your head. If they both contract, flexion. Okay, if only one contracts, then a rotation. So that's really a cool muscle to know because it looks very intimidating, sternocleidomastoid, but it's not really bad because in the name, it tells you what? Everything that you probably ever would want to know about that muscle, the origin, the insertion, and then you can figure out what? Whether it's going to cause flexion if they contract bilaterally or a lateral rotation if it's a unilateral contraction. So where the heck is that sternocleidomastoid at? We can see it in one view on this head right here. All right, so here's the sternocleidomastoid. There's the mastoid process on the temporal bone, a big, strong muscle that goes all the way to the clavicle of sternum. But this just shows you on one side, and actually what you have is what? Two of them. So, for instance, here it is on both sides of your head. On both sides of your neck right here. And can you see how if they both contract, it causes flexion, or if only one contracts, it causes a rotation? Okay, you can actually do that and feel for yourself the muscles as they're contracting. Okay, here's that frontalis. Just in passing, a lot of names for muscles are derived by what kind of shape they have. So a circular muscle, like around your eyes or around your mouth right here, that's called an orbicularis. So an orbicularis is a circular muscle that can contract, like when you want to squint, close your eyes, or pucker your lips, okay, like when you're going to play a trumpet or something. Okay, that would be the orbicularis oris around your mouth or orbicularis oculi around your eyes. Right, so actually some of these are pretty easy. Oculi means eye. Oris means mouth. Orbicularis means what? Circular. So just by looking at the name of the muscle, you get a really good idea of what kind of action it's producing. All right, another muscle. I guess this is the last muscle. Trunk muscles, the rectus abdominis. And rectus does not mean circular, because what means circular? Orbicularis. Orbicularis is circular. Rectus means straight. Rectus, I don't know why I think that's, I would know that. I don't know how why you would know that, but rectus just means straight line. Okay? All right, and abdominis means where? Like abdomen. All right, so you see any straight muscles in the abdomen? Yeah, right here. Okay? And there are common tendons or common insertions between these straight segments here, 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 and here. But the origin, all right, is on the pubic bone. The insertion is the xiphoid process and the sternum right here. So now you pretty much know what the action is, because which is the more movable end? We said the insertion is here, right? The more movable end is the insertion, and when that muscle contracts, it's gonna flex your spinal cord, no, your vertebral column, and pull your sternum down through your pubis like this. All right, so now you know the whole action of the rectus abdominis muscle, right there. So on this particular chart, what do we have? I should label it. Origin right here, and here is the insertion. Or you could say, what in terms of movement, this column is the which one? Less movable, and this is the more movable end of that particular muscle. Okay. So we're doing pretty good for the test, but one of these things here, these muscles you gotta just know by their name. Okay, so orbicularis oculi around the eye, orbicularis oris around the mouth, the frontalis right here, masseter for chewing, sternocleidomastoid for rotating your head or maybe flexing your neck, trapezius, the serratus anterior, the rectus abdominis, some of these that are angulated in your stomach. We call that the external oblique. Pectoralis muscle, the deltoid on your shoulder, the biceps in your arm, the brachialis underneath it, brachial radialis in the forearm. Okay, the most medial muscle in your thigh is the gracilis and your quadriceps. We can see some muscles of the quadriceps, namely the rectus femoris. So rectus again means what? Just this big straight muscle. And femoris just means in your thigh. Okay, yeah, femur is a part of that word. That means your thigh. Adductor muscles are located medially because adductors are going to do what? They're going to bring your limbs together. So muscles need to contract in this medial region of your thigh. Medial means towards midline. Yeah. So as opposed to lateral, which is on the outsides, right? So adductor muscles will be medial. Okay. While abductors are going to be more lateral in your thigh. Let's look at a posterior view. So I can't really see the sternocleidomastoid too well on this diagram, but we can see the trapezius nice. We still can see the deltoid, but now here's that triceps brachii. Latissimus dorsi is a posterior muscle. Gluteus maximus. And we see some hamstring muscles in the thigh. The biceps femoris, the semitendinosus and semimembranosus. These are all for flexing across the knee. And then the posterior muscles in the leg, the gastrocnemius. Gastrocnemius is a very strong muscle for plantar flexion. It forces your toes into the ground. The muscles that the antagonistic muscles to the gastrocnemius forces your toes into the ground. So the muscles that lift your toes up off the ground, all right, would be the tibialis anterior. So when these contract, it lifts your toes up off the ground. What do we call that, that motion? Is that dorsiflexion or plantar flexion? That's dorsiflexion. Okay, so those are actually pretty important motions to look at, dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. As a matter of fact, when you walk into a doctor's office, they'll probably look to see if you're doing that correctly. And, you know, a lot of times you don't walk into a doctor's office anymore. What happens to you when you go see a doctor? You're put in the room, okay, and a doctor walks in to see you, which is kind of unfortunate because of time constraints, because actually it's very good for a doctor to see you walk in and sit down and all that kind of stuff. For instance, but maybe they don't have to actually watch you walk. They can just look at your shoes, because if somebody is having trouble dorsiflexing, what do their shoes look like? They're rubbed off in the wrong part. They're rubbed off at the tips of the shoes, right? If you're having trouble lifting your toes up off the ground, you're going to be dragging your toes like that, okay, and that's going to wear off the tips of your shoes. And that's an indication of spinal cord injury, all right? So that's really handy for a physician to know. And when we start talking about the nervous system and the spinal cord, you'll see where that plays an important role. And is that important for people? Okay? Why would you think that might be important, or important for a doctor to know? Okay. Well, for instance, if you're having trouble dorsiflexing or lifting your toes up off the ground, what are you going to have a tendency to do? Besides just wreck your shoes, which is not that big a deal. Yeah, but trip. You're going to have a tendency to trip on a crack in the sidewalk or something. And if you're our age and you trip, it's no big deal. Okay? Because, what, you usually catch yourself before you fall. But what happens if you're 80 years old? Oh, you're going to fall. Okay? And then what happens if you fall, if you're an elderly person? Yeah, you're going to break something. And it's usually a hip. Okay, and then what happens? Well, you know what? That's not so far-fetched, because usually you have to convalesce, you can't do it at home because you need care for you, and you'll be in a convalescence home. And when you're that old and you're put in that strange surrounding away from family, you lose interest in life. And a lot of times people that break a hip when they're in their 80s and 90s, they don't even make it home. Okay, so knowing something about dorsiflexion and plantar flexion and what muscles are involved are pretty important. You could actually save somebody's life by paying attention to that kind of stuff. Okay, even your own grandma and grandpa at home. All right, so dorsiflexion would be this tibialis anterior. The antagonistic motion would be the gastrocnemius, as well as the soleus, which is behind it. Okay, are going to plantar flex, are going to force your toes into the ground. Okay, so how would we describe the action between the gastrocnemius and the soleus if they produce the same kind of motion? Would we call those antagonists? No, I don't like that. We would call those synergist muscles, for instance. Just like we said, the biceps and the brachialis are synergist muscles. Now, to the biceps, what would be a good example of an antagonist to the biceps muscle? The triceps, right? All right, and in terms of the ankle right here, what would be a good antagonistic muscle to the tibialis anterior? Antagonistic to the anterior, tibialis anterior would be the gastrocnemius and the soleus. Either one of those would be antagonistic to the tibialis anterior. Okay. Somebody asked a question. This is not on the test, but somebody asked a question about rotator cuff injuries. There are basically four muscles. If you want to look at muscles in somebody, and the most of them are in your back that influence the rotator cuff, but these muscles spread out and form a capsule over your shoulder, which is a connective tissue sheath around your shoulder. So the muscles are integrally connected to that capsule. And the capsule isn't as strong as the tendons or the muscles themselves, so it has a tendency to rip. Here are the four muscles that make up the rotator cuff. The supraspinatus right here, the infraspinatus, the teres minor, and the subscapularis, which you can't see. So there's a way that people try to remember rotator cuff names. It's using this acronym right here, SITS, S-I-T-S, standing for supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor, and the subscapularis. That's not on your test. But those of you that have a rotator cuff might want to look at some of these different muscles over here. And all of these muscles are in your back. They're going to pull on some anterior portion of your humerus and what? Rotate it laterally like that. Right? All of those are in your back rotating laterally. Okay. Let's see. Do we have any time to work over the study sheet? A little bit? Yeah. Let's start with fill in some of these things. Let's see if I missed anything in lecture for today. Know the characteristics of skeletal muscle. Well, what are some characteristics of skeletal muscle? What would you... Voluntary, I like that. Yeah, it contracts, but so does smooth muscle and cardiac muscle, but opposed to other kinds of muscle. It's voluntary. It is striated. I like that because smooth muscle is not striated. It's striated because it has those sarcomeres in there, sarcomere after sarcomere after sarcomere, so it's striated. Multinucleated, that's another good one. That's the only kind of muscle that's multinucleated. As a matter of fact, one of the few kind of cells that is multinucleated. You know, I don't know of any other cells really that are multinucleated. There's some white blood cells that have very complicated nuclei, have many lobes, but it's still only really one nucleus. I don't have a good example on it. Osteoclasts are multinucleated. Oh, they can be giant cells. Okay, that's interesting. But the osteoclasts are a number of cells, again, probably that have fused together to form one big cell. All right, what about functions of skeletal muscle? Functions, movement. Yeah, making bones articulate through a joint. Posture is another function. Even though bones aren't moving when you're standing still or sitting still, bones aren't moving, but you're still not what? Falling on the floor. That's what... Movement is making bones move. Yeah, movement and posture are two different things. Posture, yeah, T-U-R-E. And let's see, what else? Heat production. I think there was another one in there. Joint stabilization, very good. Because it's very hard to repair a joint. The only thing you can do once you hurt a joint is to improve the muscles that surround the joint or work across it. What is anatomy of a muscle? No, fascia. Fascia surrounds what? A whole muscle. What's the next smallest part of a muscle? That would be a bundle or a fascicle. Okay, and then a fascicle is made up of muscle fibers, which is the same thing as a cell. Muscle fibers. And then what makes up a cell? A bunch of myofibrils. And then inside a myofibril, you got the smallest unit, which is the filaments, the myofilaments. So myofilament is a building block of a fibril, and fibrils are the building block of a cell, and the cells are building blocks of fascicles. And a whole bunch of fascicles are the building block of the whole big muscle. All right, here's a good easy one. What are the two kinds of proteins that make up myofilaments? Actin and myosin. Which one is the thick one? Myosin. Thin one is the actin. And what does a Z-line represent? It's the end points of a sarcomere. Or you could say the beginning point and end point, but just say, you know, the end points. I think I know what you mean. The Z line represents the end points of a sarcomere. Sarco, S-A-R-C-O-M-E-R-E. Sarcomere. And what's the structural and functional unit of a muscle? If you want to know how a muscle shortens, all you have to know is how what shortens? Is that sarcomere? How does that sarcomere pull on the Z-lines to get it to come together? The structural and functional unit of muscle is a sarcomere. Sarcomere.
Just that one word?
Yeah, just that one word, sarcomere. Yeah, that's it. Short and sweet. Number five, what proteins contract or shorten when a muscle contracts?
None.
Is that true? Yeah, because actin and myosin don't shorten. What do? They just slide past each other, right? We call that the sliding filament model. Oh, that was number six. What, name the description or model that describes how a muscle contracts. That's the sliding filament mechanism. Sliding filament, when actin and myosin slide past each other. All right, why is muscle striated? Striated, it has something to do with those sarcomeres. Right, there's just one sarcomere after another, after another, after another, and that's just a repeated pattern over and over again. It's striated because of the sarcomeres that are inside the cell. Because of the sarcomeres lining up from end to end, from one end of the cell to the other. Okay, crossbridge. Crossbridge goes from where to where? Where is a crossbridge primarily, what, it's a part of myosin. A crossbridge is a part of myosin, but we call it a crossbridge because it can attach itself to what other protein? The actin. Under certain conditions, it can attach itself to actin and it can pull on actin. All right, so a crossbridge is a part of myosin that can reach up and grab hold of actin. And what energy molecule is needed for muscle contraction? ATP. What are two ways that ATP is synthesized? Aerobic and anaerobic respiration. Okay, so be able to discuss the differences in aerobic and anaerobic respiration in terms of its location. Okay, location. What's the difference in location? Aerobic is? Mitochondria. Anaerobic is? Cytoplasm. I've decided to sit down. Okay. Substrates. What's the substrate for aerobic respiration? There are two possible ones. Glucose is one, and fatty acids are the other. Okay. Or lipid. And anaerobic respiration, what's the substrate for anaerobic? It's only glucose. Only glucose. Only glucose is anaerobic respiration. Aerobic was glucose and fatty acid. And what about the products, especially just in terms of ATP? Anaerobic is how many ATP? Yeah, two, big deal. And for aerobic respiration, it's? Yeah, 30-something. You could say 34, 36, 38. So say 36. Okay? So a lot. Aerobic is a lot. Oh, here's a really good question. What is the reason for respiration? To produce ATP, right? So you know a lot about respiration now, namely aerobic versus anaerobic. For aerobic, you need oxygen and all that kind of stuff, and you produce CO2. But the important thing is it produces ATP. All right, should we finish these off or call it quits? Okay. So we'll start. Next time, make sure I start with what is muscle fatigue. If you didn't get a handout, the handouts are right here. Yeah, if I can find them, I'll be glad to give them back to you. I've got them graded. I don't know if I have them recorded. Okay.